Our first speaker today is Dr. Martin Smith, Professor of Toxicology and a Kenneth Howard and Marjorie Witherspoon Kaiser Endowed Chair of Cancer Epidemiology at the University of California, Berkeley. Smith is a laboratory scientist with expertise in molecular epidemiology, toxicology, and genomics, and his research is aimed at finding the causes of chronic diseases, including cancer and diabetes. Smith has led the SRP Center at UC Berkeley since its inception in 1987. The UC Berkeley SRP Center focuses on exposures to high-priority chemicals commonly found at Superfund sites, and it takes a novel approach to adopt the exposome paradigm in this research. A full bio on Dr. Smith is available on the registration page. Dr. Smith, I will now turn it over to you.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me well?
Yes, you sound great. Thank you.
Good. Thank you for inviting me. Welcome, everybody, to this interesting series of webinars. And I'm going to talk today about the key characteristics approach to hazard identification. First of all, I have a conflict of interest statement that I am retained as a consultant in U.S. litigation, mainly for plaintiffs. I don't have any formal association with IARC, US EPA, or Cal EPA, I'll be mentioning throughout the talk. I do have an ongoing contract with OEHA, part of Cal EPA, to further develop this key characteristics approach, and all the views today are completely my own. So in summary to today's talk, what I'm going to be talking about is the fact that scientific findings providing insights into mechanisms of toxicity are beginning to play an increasingly important role in hazard identification. The key characteristics that I'm going to describe as an approach provides the basis for a knowledge-based objective approach to evaluating mechanistic data. And this contrasts and complements the more reductive mode of action or adverse outcome pathway approach. Various institutions and authority bodies are now using these key characteristics, and apart from the key characteristics of carcinogens, which I'll mainly be talking about, there are now key characteristics for reproductive toxicants, endocrine disruptors, neurotoxicants, cardiotoxicants, and hepatotoxicants, which are being developed. What is needed for the future, I think, is a comprehensive set of biomarkers and assays which can measure these key characteristics of these different forms of toxicity. So why do we need key characteristics? Well, they're needed, I believe, for evidence integration when we're identifying chemical hazards. Typically, in this approach, you have four streams of evidence, one being human studies, epidemiological being very important, but these are tending to decline as less occupational epidemiology is performed. Animal studies, usually in rodents, usually long-term chronic studies. Again, less and less of these types of studies are being performed. The third stream of evidence is typically now in vitro studies, especially high-throughput studies, such as TOX21 and ToxCast. This is producing a wealth of data and is increasing in volume. Finally, you can have mechanistic data in humans in terms of biomarkers from molecular epidemiology, you can have from experimental animals and in vitro, and more recently, in silico work. This provides biological plausibility when you are doing evidence integration and is increasing importance. And so the key characteristics could help with this and also could enlighten approaches to testing, especially in the in vitro arena. So the key characteristics approach originated out of two meetings at IARC in 2012, organized by Kurt Strafe and others there, and was chaired by Vince Colliano, who's now with the California EPA. And they realized that they had serious challenges with analyzing the mechanistic data. For the human epidemiology studies, there were typically just a few to actually analyze. There were relatively few chronic bioassays to analyze for the animal studies, but for mechanistic data, there are often thousands of papers to evaluate. So the first question is, how do you actually systematically search for relevant mechanisms? And how do you bring uniformity across these assessments so that different working groups at IARC could use the same procedures? And how do you analyze a voluminous mechanistic database such as 3,000 papers on PCBs efficiently? And very importantly, how do you avoid bias towards favored mechanisms? If you have a relatively small working group, someone in the room who has a favored mechanism can strongly influence the group as a whole, and it may not be the same for someone else as a different bias towards a different mechanism. And this is important to evaluate. So the classical approach to this on mechanisms, or about analyzing mechanistic data, has been hypothesis driven. Typically this has involved developing a mode of action, in other words, a favored hypothesis. And more recently, this has morphed into the adverse outcome pathway approach to be more comprehensive. The problem with these approaches are generally that they are can be favored mechanisms, and they are also generally just hypotheses. So mechanistic hypotheses in science is great. We really, you know, scientists, we love hypotheses, and if you write an NIH grant, that's the first thing you have to develop. But hypotheses are beneficial in science because if you test it and you're wrong, you're actually happy, and means you modify their hypothesis and get closer to the truth. However, mechanistic hypotheses and risk assessment are problematic because here, if you're wrong, it's bad news because you could have made a bad risk decision that cannot easily be changed because it takes a long time for regulatory things to be put in place. And you may have caused either a medical or, you know, harm or environmental harm, or you could have produced in the opposite direction serious economic harm without any medical or environmental benefit. So this limitation of the mode of action approach focuses on favored mechanisms, especially on committees or in public databases, may introduce bias. And this bias may actually be really just implicit. You don't actually think you're being biased, but just because of your prior experience with a chemical, you could be. The mode of action on the AOP may be incomplete or wrong, as is demonstrated in the paper by Roussin and Courtin in 2012. And the other approach that I've often thought was an issue is how many actually validated AOPs would you need for 100,000 chemicals producing hundreds of different adverse outcomes? Do you need an AOP for every type of cancer, of which there are at least 200 types? And within those types, for example, myeloid neoplasms, types of leukemias, you have at least 60 different types. And so how many of these would you need? But if you do require to build an AOP or an unbiased AOP, the KCs can actually help in that role in reviewing all the literature and making sure that you've got all the different mechanisms possibility if you are needing to make one. Existing AOPs that have already been generated could also inform future KCs. I illustrate this here by showing an AOP from fish for cardiotoxicity, for toxicity to the heart. And you'll notice that the two earliest initiating events are altered potassium current, or blockage of that potassium current, and abnormal intracellular cancer handling. And it actually turns out that in the cardiotoxicity group, for developing KCs has used these two as the first two key characteristics that they identified of chemicals which cause cardiotoxicity. The key characteristics approach was actually looked at by the National Academy of Sciences group, who developed using 21st century science to improve risk-related evaluations, and they concluded that the key characteristic approach avoided this narrow focus on specific pathways or hypotheses and provided a broad holistic consideration of the mechanistic evidence. The committee also noted at that time that the key characteristics for other hazards, such as cardiovascular and reproductive toxicity, could be developed as a guide. And their potential to pose a hazard and their contribution to risk. And so this put into our minds that we could develop other key characteristics apart from the key characteristics of carcinogens. And one of the members of this committee, of this National Academy Committee, was Lauren Zeiss, who heads the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment in California EPA, and recognized that maybe we should develop key characteristics for the different hazard traits that are present in California legislation. So California is somewhat unique in that it has these different hazard traits which you can use to regulate chemicals, and they are the properties of chemicals. And there are 19 toxicological traits, but there are also other traits such as bioaccumulation or persistence in the environment. But for the 19 toxicological traits shown here, you can see that we have developed or are beginning to develop key characteristics for chemicals which cause these hazard traits. This includes carcinogenesis at the top and genotoxicity. We've also developed ones for reproductive toxicity, for endocrine disruptors, which Michelle and Merrill will talk about in just a few minutes. And we are developing ones currently for cardiovascular disease, neurological toxicity, and hepatotoxicants. In the fall, we plan to try and develop key characteristics for immunological toxicants and for agents which cause metabolic disease. So the committee at IARC in 2012 started to sketch out these ideas of key characteristics of human carcinogens, and then with a large effort which involved a number of people at EPA, at NTP and elsewhere, we developed this set of key characteristics of human carcinogens, which were eventually published at the end of 2015. And there are 10 of them. These came initially from extensive discussions by the committee. And many people always say to me, well, they're really obvious. And the thing is, that's kind of the point. It's meant to be an approach that aspects of carcinogenesis that everybody agrees upon. And we use the, in this case, the known human carcinogens, the list of known human carcinogens, as the basis for forming these set of key characteristics. And this work was really taken to real fruition with the help of Kate Guyton, who joined IARC soon after these meetings. So we started, of course, with the obvious ones. The well-known carcinogens that we know about are electrophilic and genotoxic, and that's the top two. And as we go further down, you become in things like immunosuppression, which is very specific really for things like lymphoma and various other specific types of cancers, and less general. And so we managed to capture, I think, all of the classical key characteristics of the known human carcinogens, which included viruses, infectious agents, and radiation, and really led to this key characteristic number 9, causing immortalization, and altered genomic instability as being key for radiation. This was the from the original paper on this, where we gave examples of relevant evidence, such as DNA damage for being genotoxic, or alterations in DNA replication in the player for number 3, and the different types of epigenetic alterations, etc. Further examples of relevant evidence would be decreased immunosurveillance and immune system dysfunction. And notice that for altered cell proliferation and cell death, what matters here is actually blocking apoptosis, not causing apoptosis. Dead cells can't become cancerous, and so what you actually want is to decrease apoptosis and increase proliferation in order to generate cancer. So now a series of papers have been published on the key characteristics of carcinogens, beginning with the one in 2016 I mentioned. In a paper by Kate Guyton and others, there's a discussion of how IARC has applied them initially in their early work. And most recently, we've published a summary of their relationship to the hallmarks of cancer and relevant biomarkers and assays to measure them, which is part of an ongoing project. So How are the key characteristics differ to the hallmarks of cancer? Why are they not hallmarks? Well, the hallmarks of cancer, which were first described in 2000 by Hanahan and Weinberg and updated in 2011, as shown here, are a series of properties of cancer cells or tumors in general. They're not the properties of the agents which cause cancer. And a way of explaining this was put best by Bill Goodson, who was on a committee with us recently. He said, well, a hallmark describes what is. It's the biology of the cancer or the tumor. And a key characteristic of a chemical or an agent is the property that makes this what is, this biology, happen. And so the key characteristics are of a carcinogen are the properties that make it carcinogenic. So they're quite different to a hallmark in this case. Earlier on, in a very important paper resulting from the Halifax Project, Bill Goodson and others presented how different disruptive environmental chemicals may act at different places on the pathway to carcinogenesis, leading to the possibility that chemicals could act in concert together and act on different hallmarks or generating different hallmarks. In other words, the chemicals would have characteristics which cause the what is, the hallmark, to happen at different places in the process. And so a mixture of chemicals could produce cancers even from relatively low dose exposures. And this was a novel discussion at the time. And it's an important one, and it shows that this and this work from the Halifax Project and this work on the key characteristics of carcinogens has shown that it's very important to consider both genotoxic and non-genotoxic effects, because many of the key characteristics you'll see that we described, they are unrelated to genotoxicity, although some may result from mutations, such as the inhibition of DNA repair, genomic instability and oxidative stress and inflammation. But it means that both genotoxic and non-genotoxic effects could be important in cancer development, and it means that genotoxic and non-genotoxic carcinogens could act in concert. So I'm somewhat frustrated often by toxicologists' view of carcinogenesis. There's an old-fashioned view that DNA damage only really occurs and mutations only occur in the initiation process of cancer, and that subsequent to that, promotion occurs without any mutation at all. And suddenly this initiated cell gets translated into a tumor several years later through promotional effects which are non-genotoxic. And this is a slide that actually Brian Berridge showed at his last, in this opening session of these talks, in which he followed up and said that the key characteristics showed that this was somewhat naive and old-fashioned. And that what we now know, of course, is that mutations occur throughout cancer development, leading to the selection of particular clones. Now, whether you believe in the clonal evolution hypothesis of cancer or whether you believe in the cancer stem cell one, the same thing basically happens, that through selective pressure, a clone develops that can metastasize and produce effects in other organs, and that a dominant clone takes over. On the bottom right, you'll see this is graphically illustrated for pancreatic cancer, where mutations occur throughout the process of cancer development, and that there is clonal proliferation of these mutated clones. And in the top right, from a paper in Nature, you can see that apart from mutations, there are all sorts of effects of the microenvironment, of inflammation, of the immune surveillance, which have major implications for cancer development, including as well angiogenesis and the physical supply of blood and other nutrients to the tumor. And so there are many things apart from just mutations which produce cancer. And this also explains the long latency that you to get a visual tumor in this selective approach or clonal or evolutionary approach to understanding cancer. So if you start to think about that in terms of the of the key characteristics, you can, and the Halifax project, you can see that chemicals on the right, which have the different KC properties, could produce, for example, genotoxicity and genomic instability early on to initiate the cancer. There could be receptor-mediated proliferative signaling to produce sustained proliferative signaling, the resistance to cell death from the inhibition of apoptosis, the replicative immortality from altering telomeres, et cetera, et cetera. And so different chemicals could actually produce these different effects. And so you could have a combination of chemicals which was a carcinogen. And we're working on this concept at the moment with Cynthia Ryder from NTP and several others of the working group. We're preparing a paper on how the key characteristics could develop research on environmental mixtures and cancer. This group also looked at how we would actually measure the key characteristics. And so we put together a working group which included three people from Amgen, and they are particularly interested in developing a toolbox where you can measure the key characteristics. And we put together a listing of representative assays that could measure the key characteristics. This has just been published in Cancer Epidemiology, Biomarkers and Prevention. And we actually have a project ongoing where we are trying to delineate all of the assays which measure the different key characteristics, and we're hoping to make this publicly available soon. The Amgen interest came really on this idea from Mark Fielden and others, and Herb Lebrecht, who are on this paper, and Shiro Menacherej, who are interested in developing a toolbox for risk assessment where they could assess a drug, for example, for its ability to cause the 10 key characteristics to improve predictive toxicology prior to putting things into preclinical or preclinical testing. As you'll hear in a minute, we also had working group that developed key characteristics of endocrine disruptors and reproductive toxicants, as shown here. And they three papers resulted from this group that have been published in Environmental Health Perspectives and Nature Reviews Endocrinology, describing these key characteristics. Finally, we are also now developing key characteristics for neurotoxicants, with Pam Lyon chairing it and Thomas Hartung, and that paper is in development, as is a paper on the key characteristics of cardiotoxicants, whose affiliates are shown here. So how are the KCs used? Who is using them? How are they using them? Well, this just gives an example of some of the papers that have come out on the key characteristics. There's the application of the key characteristics carcinogens from Guyton et al. In 2018, which also contains in a supplement the keywords which are used to, or search terms which are used to review the literature. And they also are strongly described in the new IARC preamble that was published in 2019. The NTP with Atwood et al. Have described the use of the KCs in their report on carcinogens for the study of haloacetic acids and how they found them to be highly useful for that review. And Chappelle et al. From Tox Strategies have used them to, for example, do a systematic evaluation of the mechanistic data for chemicals such as sucralose, where they show that they're not likely to be carcinogenic based upon the review. And also, and quite contrastingly, the Environmental Working Group with Temkin et al. Have published that the compounds known as PFAS have many of the key characteristics of carcinogens and have suggested that this be that they be further evaluated. So the important part of the IARC new preamble is that there is the introduction of a separate line for mechanistic evidence. And this is based largely on the key characteristics. If you have strong mechanistic evidence in exposed humans, you can move a chemical into group one. This has actually always been true and is true for things like dioxin and ethylene oxide and is really just a continuation of that approach. But interestingly, if there is strong evidence mechanistically in experimental systems, this now allows you to say something is possibly carcinogenic. And there has been some controversy about the use of key characteristics in IARC evaluations, but they have been really relatively only significant in only a couple of cases. And generally, for example, on some of the more controversial compounds, some pesticides, for example, the evidence was limited in humans and sufficient in experimental animals, and the mechanistic evidence was not particularly relevant, and a decision could already be made. And so they are becoming increasingly used, and they are well described in this preamble about how they should be used in this evaluation. Catherine Guyton put this together now because they've now evaluated over 50 chemicals in 13 different monographs, and so this is a summary of the experience that we've had so far with them. We're hoping to present this at this year's SOT meeting, but unfortunately that was cancelled. The Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment has also been using the key characteristics, as you can see here, and published several reports, and so they've facilitated some systematic review and assisted in the development of MOAs and AOPs through unbiased reviews. And this approach has been taken by using targeted searches with set keywords for each characteristics and then organizing the results through some programs such as HAWK, and then fully evaluating the evidence in particular bins, which allows a working group to efficiently do this. We're also hoping that the key characteristics will improve predictive toxicology and molecular epidemiology for disease prevention, and that we can get a set of tests based on key characteristics of different types of toxicities to better predict whether the hazards that chemicals present. And this basically forms the basis of, forms the basis of an approach that the pharmaceutical companies and other people, including National Toxicology Program, are interested in pursuing. Finally, I would like to point out that what we've noticed is that there are the key characteristics for different types of toxicities or different toxicants overlap, that genotoxicity is seen in both male and female reproduction, reproductive toxicants and neurotoxicants, for example, that epigenetic alterations have been identified as key characteristics for all five of these now. So have modulation of receptor-mediated effects and altered cell proliferation. But this suggests that there may be key characteristics of bioactive hazardous chemicals that initially what we could potentially do is a first-tier test for chemicals which have bioactivity and could potentially be hazardous, followed up by specific measurements of their effects on particular systems. This is also suggested by recent work that one of my master students has done, Sarah Dahlberg, where she actually mapped the different key characteristics between the carcinogens, the endocrine disruptors, and the reproductive toxicants, and you can see that there are many overlaps, and that, for example, hormone signaling in female reproduction links to a lot of the endocrine disrupting properties and also to carcinogen key characteristic number 8, etc. And so there is a lot of overlap between these different key characteristics, which means that we may have be able to identify a set of key characteristics for hazardous chemicals in general. And with that, I would thank you for listening and thank for the financial support from the California EPA and also from the NIHS through our Superfund research program. And this work is funded by the Research Translation Corps. I also want to especially thank Catherine Guyton of IARC, who has helped develop this whole approach and has been very important in doing so. And I want to thank the many scientists who have contributed their time and knowledge. I'm going to leave you with a list of those. So far, 90 people have from 43 different institutions in 11 countries have all volunteered their time completely free of charge and have participated very actively in this. And now Dr. Ivan Rusin of the Superfund Research Center at Texas A&M is developing key characteristics of a hepatotoxicants working group with over another 10 people. So more than 100 people now have participated in the development of these key characteristics. Thank you very much again for inviting me.
Thank you, Martin. This is a really interesting presentation. We really appreciate you giving us an overview of the key characteristic concept, where it came from, how it's being used, as well as a little bit of a sneak peek to the next presentation that we'll be talking about, endocrine disruption. Let's turn to the questions and see if I would invite anyone to submit questions using the Q&A pod, which is again at the lower right corner of the screen today. Martin, how many key characteristics are needed to say something as a carcinogen?
Yeah, it's a question we get a lot. The answer is it can be as few as one, or it can be more than all of them. The point is really that it's not really a number where you add up, oh, with four, then it's got to be a carcinogen. What matters is the strength of the finding. And so if there is very strong evidence for a key characteristic that clearly is involved in the mechanism by which the chemical produces cancer or endocrine disruption, then you may only need one or perhaps two. Whereas for other chemicals, things like arsenic, benzene, we know that they produce very large numbers of the key characteristics. And so this is sort of more overwhelming evidence that they are carcinogenic. But there is no minimal number, and there is no maximum number. It really depends on the strength of the evidence. And of course, it's one of the only lines of evidence that you also look at. You also look at the epidemiological evidence, the animal evidence, and the in vitro evidence, and combine that with this review of the mechanistic evidence. You don't just use the mechanistic evidence on its own generally.
Great, thank you. Question about the relevant biomarkers and assays. You mentioned that that is a paper that's coming out. Wondering if it takes into account or has guidance for exposure route.
Yes, I mean, it will. I mean, the important thing we wanted to do was basically make a list of all of the assays and how good they are at predicting that particular key characteristic. So there's obviously many measures of genotoxicity, for example. So how good are they? Are they in human cells? Are they in bacteria? What's the endpoint? Is it very relevant to cancer? So that's kind of where we're going to. But also part of that, once you've got that particular set of assays, what matters then is evaluating at what doses do the effects occur and by what route if it's a molecular epidemiology biomarker. And so that all comes into part of the evaluation of the actual studies that are done using those particular assays. What we're trying to do right now is to get expert opinion on which are the best assays which predict the key characteristics and where are the gaps, where do we need to develop better assays and incorporate them into our evaluations.
Thank you. Another question, new approach methods, NAMs, and HTS assays are becoming an important component of hazard evaluation and risk assessment. How can the KC's approach help inform the development of new assays?
I think that follows on from what I just said. I think that's a very good point, a very good question. What we'd really like to see would be a set of assays which were very good at predicting the different key characteristics of different types of toxicants, and that these could be part of a series of NAMs which were then used to evaluate, used in vitro to systematically evaluate whether a chemical produces these key characteristics in that particular setting and at what doses. And so I think one of the great things about the key characteristics is that it could lead to a set of standardized tests, which and NAMs, which we could use to better predict toxicity, combined with machine learning and computational approaches. I think we could have a much better prediction of toxicity from those.
Great, thank you. You mentioned four data streams earlier, the human, animal, in vitro, and mechanistic, but IARC and other agencies typically do not call out in vitro. Should they be treating that data as separate data stream?
I think that they are, I don't want to speak for IARC, but there was discussion of that, and they have started to use high-throughput testing data, as have the California EPA. I think it's more a question to them. I think as more of that data becomes available, as the methods become more validated and standardized, I think that that definitely will be used. Currently, it's mostly used within the mechanistic data framework, but I think there are really going to become four streams of evidence, because the mechanistic evidence can also come from molecular epidemiology studies, not just in vitro studies, for example, or from animal studies using transgenic animals and things like this. So I think eventually, as the new methodologies become more accepted and more useful, I think the regulatory agencies will probably start using them as a separate stream of evidence.
Great, thank you. Given the background cancer rate in the U.S. Of 1 to 3, how does this approach help to elucidate the underlying mechanisms or causes of this background level?
Well, let's just think. So we can only explain a certain percentage of those cancers. And so we now know that it's almost 1 in 2 now, as people, as the population ages, that get cancer, and that we 1 in 3 or so die from it, or 1 in 4. We only know a certain amount of about what causes those cancers. We can only explain a certain percentage of that. And so if we can better identify what which chemicals, which environmental chemicals, or which agents in our environment act together to produce those cancers, we can get a better understanding of the etiology and increase the percentage that we understand. And that's kind of really what the goal of this work is, and of hazard identification in general.
Great, thank you. Another question, can you use the predictive power of KCs for substances with known epi to predict these effects in new subpopulations with no epi yet?
I don't know. I haven't thought about that. I'm not sure what's meant by subpopulations in that context. I mean, if the epidemiology predicts that the chemical has an effect in humans, I'm not sure that we'd need KCs to look at subpopulations for that. So I'm sorry, I don't really have a clear answer to that question.
Okay. Well, we do have another one. How do you see playing a part in this research? Are current methods working well, or do we need to improve those tools?
I'm sorry, you broke up a bit in the middle of that.
Sorry. How do you see statistical methods for identifying mixtures playing a part in this research? Are current methods working well, or do we need to improve those tools?
Oh, I think that's a really important area of research that some of my colleagues at Berkeley, and I know others like Tom Webster and Andreas Kortenkamp in Brunel, and Tom at Boston University, they're all working on this. I think statistical approaches are going to really be very significant. One of the things we're working on is, can you actually use machine learning and a new form of statistics to actually look at multiple chemicals in a mixture and better predict them with new statistical technologies. And so we're actively working on that. I think other groups are. I think it's a really critical area of research.
Great. And we did get a clarification about the questions. It was not subpopulations, it was substances with no epi yet. So the question was, can you use the predictive power of KCs for substances with known epi to predict these effects in new substances with no epi yet?
Yeah, the idea of can you read across or something what I think it could be used for, the key characteristics, you couldn't say, for example, if a chemical produces a key characteristic or a set of key characteristics that it's a human carcinogen. What it could be used, though, is to say that that's a good one to start looking at. We need to prioritize that to look at that in other experimental systems and in humans if they are exposed to significant levels. So I think that the key characteristics are kind of a prioritization tool rather than a direct predictive tool.
Excellent. Well, thank you for clarifying that and for the questioner for clarifying their question so that we could get a better answer. Thank you so much, Dr. Smith, for this presentation. If there are any more questions that have come in, we will try to take them at the end when we have more time for both presenters. But what we'd like to do right now is move on to our next presenter, Dr. Michelle LaMerrill. She is an associate professor in the Department of Environmental Toxicology in the College of Agriculture and Environmental Sciences at the University of California, Davis. The mission of the LaMerrill Laboratory is to understand the mechanistic basis of environmental causes of endocrine diseases. They conduct cellular, whole animal, and human epidemiological studies to integrate human observations with mechanistic investigations. LaMerrill earned her PhD in toxicology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill through the mentorship of David Threadgill and Linda Birnbaum on the interactions of prenatal dioxin exposure and high-fat diet on mammary cancer and metabolic syndrome risk. LaMerrill earned her MPH in epidemiology during her postdoctoral fellowship at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City. A full bio is available on the webinar page. And Dr. LaMerrill, I will now turn it over to you.
Great. Can you hear me?
Yes, you sound great.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I appreciate the invitation to present our work today, and thank you to the audience that has joined in. Okay, so I thought I'd just briefly touch on the concept of what is an endocrine-disrupting chemical. So I like to use the definition provided by the professional organization, the Endocrine Society, which is an exogenous, non-natural chemical or a mixture of chemicals that interferes with any aspect of hormone action, and that was taken from this position statement referenced in this slide. So I'd like to talk about this in the context of overweight and obesity. These are endocrine diseases closely associated with a concept called insulin resistance, and you can see here that the prevalence of overweight and obesity has been rising worldwide in both developed and developing nations and in both adults and in children. So a lot of people ask the question of why is this increasing happening? It's certainly changing faster than a lone genetic cause would predict. And we often think about it as influenced by key risk factors such as diet and exercise. But that concept of those two risk factors doesn't account for the fact that it's also been observed that body weight and obesity have been rising in different animals over time. So here's a graph showing a highly significant trend of increasing body weight and obesity in 8 different species of animals, representing over 20,000 different animals themselves. And some of these animals are domestic dogs and cats. You can imagine that maybe the cats are eating more table scraps and the dogs aren't getting walked enough. This also captures control primates from the primate centers around the United States. It also captures control rodents from government labs, such as the National Toxicology Program. We also have data in here representing rats found in urban areas such as Baltimore and in rural areas of the Midwest of the United States. And this really points to a concern that you can't really explain away these trends with the simple diet and exercise model. So when we think about how to get our heads around this, I'll touch briefly on a point that Dr. Smith had just brought up, and that is, how do we decide if a chemical is a carcinogen? And one of the trends he mentioned was that epidemiological data, as well as rodent assays, have been decreasing in numbers over time, whereas we have increasing wealth of information from mechanistic studies, including in vitro type assays. And this idea of being able to create a framework as the key characteristics of carcinogens to organize the data on the properties of chemicals can help us make decisions even if we don't have a complete mechanistic pathway. So we thought, let's apply this concept to endocrine disruption and also reproductive toxicants, as you just heard. That meeting that Dr. Smith described was in Berkeley in 2018, hosted by Cal EPA. I have ongoing funding from OEHA as part of Cal EPA to work on hazard identification of endocrine disrupting chemicals. But in this effort, Dr. Tom Zoller and I were leading this evaluation that became a consensus statement representing government and academic experts from around the world. And what we came up with were a set of 10 different properties of endocrine disrupting chemical characteristics. And the first half of them really relate to the activity that happens at the receptor level, and the next four are really about the hormones kind of life course. And the last one is more of a self-fate one. And so the first characteristic is being a ligand or an agonist of a receptor. And the second is a receptor antagonist. The third is the ability of a chemical to disrupt the receptor's expression. And the fourth being disruption of the signal transduction that is normally resulting from appropriate receptor activation. The fifth key characteristic of an ADC is altering the epigenome, and moving on to kind of the hormone life cycle aspects of key characteristics, an ADC can disrupt hormone synthesis, transport, distribution or into individual tissues or just the circulation, as well as the hormone breakdown or clearance. And then we also know, which is pertinent to especially the developmental susceptibility concept, is this idea that an endocrine disruptor can change the fate of a cell either through proliferation or cell death or differentiation. So I'd like to use the chemicals DDT and its metabolite DDE as model chemicals to reveal the mechanisms of obesogens and how that fits into the key characteristic framework. So you may be asking, well, what does yesterday's chemical have to do with today's diseases? And I'd like to remind you of the concept of developmental origins of adult disease. So you can see here in this figure, this idea that a chemical exposure during development can have lasting effects. And we're showing that each of the three layers of a blastocyst are eventually differentiating into different tissues that are critical for insulin signaling and obesity risk, and that being brain, skeletal muscle, adipose tissue, the liver, and the pancreas. And we know that the brain doesn't really complete its development until the early part of your 20s. And so you've really got a large window of susceptibility to chemical exposures that could result in obesity or insulin resistance problems. So if we look at a framework that might be kind of analogous to the approach used by IARC, where we gather the evidence for phenotypes in humans, phenotypes in animals, and then mechanistic data, we can focus first on the human evidence, of which there's over 100 epidemiology studies of DDT or DDE, and many of them are cross-sectional, but numerous of those studies are also longitudinal. And in particular, many of them are also assessing exposure prenatally. And in those studies, it's revealed that the DDT and DDE exposure can cause or be associated with outcomes such as obesity, diabetes, as well as infertility and cancers. So to focus on the obesity for the sake of time, here I'm showing you several meta-analyses and systematic reviews that have looked at the association of DDE with obesity and all found a positive direction of association. Here you can see at the bottom a paper that was published by my group a few years ago and the OEHA Cal EPA, where we found that the majority of evidence that informed the conclusion that these are obesogens actually came from prenatal exposure to DDE and subsequent obesity in children. We have been collaborating with Dr. Barbara Cohn, who's the principal investigator of the Child Health and Development Studies, for many years now. The Child Health and Development Studies is a prospective birth cohort that started in the 1960s, enrolling about 15,000 pregnant women into the study when they were seeking OBGYN care at Kaiser Permanente. And there is a follow-up now of the adult daughters as well as the granddaughters. And in part of those samples, we were able to assess the maternal serum samples that were banked from the 1960s, and over 500 of those samples, GCMS analysis has been done to look at a mixture of about 20 persistent organic pollutants, including DDT and DDE. So this is about over 50 years of follow-up in the adult children of this study. And we just published a paper showing that prenatal exposure to DDT in the 1960s in the California Bay Area is associated with increased risk of adiposity as well as obesity. So here I've graphed the association with waist circumference and BMI based on the quartiles of that prenatal exposure. And we also see significant associations when we model it as overt obesity defined by either of these outcome variables. And these associations are robust to adjustment for confounders, including thyroid disease and exercise level risk factors. A number of years ago, an analysis was performed looking at the studies available to date of DDE and DDT, showing that most of those studies had a positive association between these chemicals and diabetes as well. We've done some preliminary analysis in our group looking at whether or not obesity might modify the diabetes risk, and when we stratify the studies, due to the BMI of the study subject, we can see that the association between DDE and diabetes increases as you go from normal weight, overweight, to obese categories. So now I'd like to shift and show you some of the phenotype data in animals. There's in two different rodent species, studies that have been done with developmental exposure to DDT, which, as you know, metabolizes into DDE. And these studies have shown that these exposures lead to increased body fat and body mass in subsequent generations. There's also been three rodent species studied looking at exposure to DDT or DDE directly, showing that these can disrupt energy expenditure. So in the bottom left, you can see some scales where we're looking at the range of exposures in the human study, down here that were part of our meta-analysis published in EHP a few years ago. And then directly aligned are the corresponding dose ranges in the two animal studies observing increased body and fat mass. And what you can see is those two studies have exposure levels in the animal models that are aligned and within the range of many of the human studies. Now you can see in these graphs, this is taken from a study that we performed a number of years ago showing that when we use prenatal DDT exposure in mice when they're developing, we're actually generating a level of circulating DDT that's within the range of the top quartile of the CHDS study that I just shared with you. And when those mice are adults, we assess by MRI that they do in fact have increased fat mass. When those mice further age out, what we observe is evidence that their energy expenditure is decreased by a variety of measures. So here in the top left, you can see that their body temperature is decreased throughout much of their life, and this decrease in body temperature becomes more severe with age. This is reflected in indolor explimetry on the top right. You can see that their energy expenditure averaged in a 24-hour window from a week's worth of data is consistently lower if they had that prenatal DDT exposure when the mice are 6 months old. And this is reflected in the oxygen consumption of the mice. And you could think of oxygen consumption as representative roughly of resting metabolic rate when the animals are during their daytime. We can see that they are moving a bit, and so that's not a completely true resting metabolic rate, but you can see that this trend of decreased oxygen consumption is present there. And although we like to think that physical activity will modify our obesity risk, it generally is thought to only account for about 20% of our energy expenditure, whereas this metabolic rate is really driving the majority of the energy that we expend each day. The last part of energy expenditure is actually what's described as adaptive thermogenesis, and this is our response to diet as well as to ambient temperature. And so we subjected the animals to a colder environment and looked at how they could defend their body temperature. And you can see that 6 months after the prenatal exposure, the mice that had that exposure had a more severe decrease in their body temperature. So they weren't able to defend themselves against the cold as well as their unexposed peers. So if this prenatal exposure is important, we suspect that we should be able to detect some defects earlier in life as well as in that adult stage I discussed. And here what you can see is studies we've done in mice at postnatal day 5, which is the last day of the exposure. We selected this day because this is a critical day for adipose tissue programming, and then also looking at postnatal day 5. And what you can see is that when we subject the animals to cold temperatures, which we're doing here as time away from the nest, they also cannot defend their bodies against the cold. So we can now think about transitioning this into the organization of mechanistic data to help us understand these observations at the whole organism level. And so, oh dear, I've got a little typo there. It says mechanistic evidence for BPA, but please excuse me, that is DDT and DDE here in this table. We've got the endocrine disrupting characteristics that I highlighted in the figure here on the left. And you can see on the right, I've mapped the data I'm aware of as a researcher in DDT to each of these characteristics. Now, I've highlighted in bold those that are most obviously related to risk of obesity and insulin resistance. And I'll give you some examples of what that data actually looks like in the subsequent slides. So here you can see an example of how DDT has been associated with impaired insulin signaling. For those of you that are not familiar with signal transduction by insulin and its receptor, I've made a diagram here for you to show you how insulin signaling works. So in a healthy organism, once insulin's bound its receptor, you have activation of ERK and AKT by phosphorylation. This causes a depression of GSK3 signaling through its phosphorylation being reduced and downstream effects such as glucose uptake. And insulin resistance is characterized by insulin failing to activate these phosphorylation events. And you can see here, consistent with insulin resistance, we've looked at a Western blot of the liver proteins, and you can see that we have the opposite direction of change when we have the DDT exposure. So these are in the mice that are now 9 months after their prenatal exposure, and they've got reduced AKT and ERK, which are supposed to be increased by insulin signaling, and we have increase in GSK, which should be decreased when insulin signaling is working consistent with impaired or insulin resistance. We've also done some work to look at the DNA methylation in relation to DDT and DDE exposures. And so what we're showing here is related to the KC5 about epigenetic modifications of endocrine disrupting chemicals. And I've got these maroon boxes around the three parts of the pathway that we were just talking about in the Western blot. And so on the left, you can see those are from our infant mouse blood. And on the right, we can see human blood. So we're attempting to say, can we use blood as a biomarker to potentially get at some of the relevant signals we're seeing at the relevant tissue? And we're looking for cells that are really essentially the same color on both sides to show us that the signal is consistent between both species. And what you can see here is that we have increased DNA methylation in human and mouse blood of ERK, the protein that's involved in downstream insulin signaling. We can also see changes in insulin signaling in adipocytes. So this is a study done by a different research team led by Rusin et al. 10 years ago. And here what you can see is the normal response of insulin, of the adipocytes to insulin is in white, where increasing doses of insulin cause a greater amount of glucose uptake in the adipocytes. As you add DDTs as a mixture that they found representative in farmed Atlantic salmon, you can see a dose-dependent decrease in the insulin-stimulated glucose uptake of the adipocytes, again, consistent with insulin resistance. If we look at the next five key characteristics, we again have an effect of DDT or DDE mapped to each of them, and we again have this typo about the bisphenol A. I've, again, highlighted for you the points of each of these that relate specifically to phenotypes being supported for the obesity and the insulin resistance. So let's look at some of that data. Here you can see we've got mice that have been exposed to DDT and DDE have increased levels of circulating insulin. So in metabolic research, we often use high-fat diet to reveal subtle metabolic deficiencies. And when these mice are exposed to this poor diet environment in their adulthood, that prenatal exposure DDT is really what pushes them over the edge where they're producing quite a bit of insulin. Now, insulin being increased all by itself is nothing to be concerned about. We want to do that normally after a meal to pull that glucose out of our blood supply. And you can look at that through a glucose tolerance test where after a fasting period, you give the animals a sugary drink and you look at how quickly the insulin is able to get the glucose out of their blood. And you can see that despite having a lot of insulin, this high-fat diet, prenatal exposure to DDT combination causes the worst glucose excursion in a lot of them. Again, those are 9-month-old mice. So if we want to then kind of think about an integration of the, or a summary of the mechanisms, really there's tens of thousands of mechanistic scientific papers on DDT and DDE, and they really provide substantial evidence for all of the 10 cases of EDCs. So some of the key aspects that are related to supporting the phenotypes of obesity and insulin resistance and diabetes include preventing the internalization of the TSH receptor and reduced expression of deiodinase 2 in brown adipose tissue, which I didn't take time to share with you today, the altered DNA methylation and the insulin signaling, as well as type 2 diabetes pathways in both humans and animals, that increase in circulating insulin level, and this impairment of the insulin signaling cascade that we observed at the Western blotting and glucose uptake of adipocytes. So just to put it into context, you may be thinking, well, DDT levels have gone down, so perhaps this isn't a major concern. I will remind you that we are seeing these trends with prenatal DDE exposure as well. And these effects of being obesogenic and increasing risk of type 2 diabetes are really supported by this energy expenditure problem. And these are not the only chemicals that cause obesity and diabetes by disrupting energy expenditure. So the atypical antipsychotics are another class of chemicals which have the same type of mechanism. The most famous for its reproduction across genomic studies of humans is the FTO gene, which has been consistently associated with obesity risk. Its mechanism has been shown to be perturbed energy regulation. And a similar story has also been revealed by another environmental pollutant, which is prenatal tobacco. So with that, I'd just like to acknowledge the EDC KC group participants, particularly Tom Zoller, who helped lead that massive effort to come up with a consensus statement, as well as my past postdocs who I showed earlier, Dr. German Conyer Sancho and Dr. Sarah Elmore, as well as my funding with OEHA and the NIEHS. And I'm happy to take any of your questions.
Thank you very much. That was a great overview of, again, the key characteristics as it relates to endocrine disruption. We do encourage you to submit your questions now. You can use the Q&A pod that you see in the lower right corner to submit your questions. So here's one that came in. Has anyone detected any synergistic effects of chemical exposure combined with radiation exposures? That is, can radiation exposure combined with chemical pollutants amplify the overall adverse effects?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think
synergy is a fascinating subject. I unfortunately haven't myself investigated synergy with radiation, and I'm not familiar with any studies that have looked at that. I certainly think that would be interesting to pursue.
Great. Next, we have a bit of a comment that perhaps you'd like to react to, and I'll just go ahead and read it. Hormones and endocrine disruptors work in vivo by epigenetic as opposed to mutagenic or cytotoxic mechanisms. So you mentioned four classes of action, and this person is saying in vivo there is a fifth level of action, namely 3D tissues, homeostatic control of cell proliferation, differentiation, and apoptosis through two forms of cell-to-cell communication, that being extracellular communication via hormones, growth factors, and cytokines, but also through non-natural factors that would inhibit gap junction intercellular communication. And there are several contaminants, the DDT being one of them, PBB, phthalate, TCDD, that are part of that inhibition. Apparently DDT was one of the first chemicals shown to reversibly block the gap junction intercellular communication above threshold levels. The other two important concepts about these epigenetic toxicants is when they have irreversible effects in utero on organ-specific adult stem cells. And these chemicals affect the differentiation of these stem cells and the number of these stems. So that was the comment. I don't know if there's something there you would like to react.
Sure. I mean, I think that's a great comment, and it highlights a point that is certainly worth emphasizing here. In the scope of time I had, I wasn't able to thoroughly discuss everything that we know about DDT, certainly with the tens of thousands of papers available. That would not really be possible here, but I believe that the KC10, which involves self-fate, is exactly aligned with the comments, both in terms of the cell's fate and its ability to have appropriate gap junctions, and also that disruption of differentiation from the in utero exposure. And so certainly I gave examples today that were biased by the fact that I used my personal expertise in the DDT literature rather than doing a formal systematic review of those tens of thousands of papers. And so there's going to be many more examples to make those tables even larger than the examples I put on my slides today.
Well, we appreciate the 10 that you did put up and being able to put the gap junction in the context of the FATE group. So thanks very much for that response and for the questioner for that very nice question. We have a few more. How do perinatal maternal DDT doses compare with environmental exposure levels?
So how do the doses compare to the environmental levels? Well, you know, we haven't formally looked at environmental matrices like soil, for example, but we have made those comparisons to human biological matrices, including serum, blood, and adipose tissue, and the levels that we're seeing in our mouse serum after the last dose, which was in our study postnatal day 5, we're already within that range of the epidemiology studies that we did the systematic review to show that DDT and DDE are obesogens. We've also just recently gotten the exposure assessment of the amount of DDT and DDE in the adipose tissue of the mice when they're 4 months old to try and figure out if there's a contribution of lingering exposure to those persistent organic pollutants during their lifespan. And when they were 4 months old, we found very low levels that were far lower than the levels seen in human adipose tissue and contemporary samples where people haven't had exposures that are, you know, abnormal or during a time when it wasn't yet banned. So basically, the levels that we had measured would have been below the limit of detection by most labs. So we happened to collaborate with a lab that has a very sensitive assay, Dr. Kurt Pennell. And so we really think that that exposure is coming from that developmental window rather than a persistent adult level. And we think that these exposures in the mouse model I discussed are relevant to the human exposures.
Great, thank you. I'm going to pick another question that kind of takes you in a similar direction to expound, because we only have time for maybe one more question. But this is a comment from somebody working with an elderly African-American farm workers who are chronically exposed to organochlorine pesticides, including DDT, DDE, and they've been unable over the last 20 years to get scientific studies to look at long-term chronic health effects in this population, and the offspring have health problems. So the question is, can you discuss any studies on DDT and DDE in autoimmune disease? Many of the farm workers have lupus and other autoimmune diseases.
Yes, that's a really interesting question. I haven't seen any studies in that area. I'm not an immunologist by training, and so I have not as much experience in keeping my finger on that area of research. I do know that a group has shown that there was a vaccine provided to people in Europe, and those people had decreased vaccine efficacy as a result of or associated with their DDT, DDE exposure. And so I think there's certainly evidence out there that they're able to be immunomodulatory chemicals, but I don't know if the autoimmune has been evaluated.
Great. Well, thank you. I just wanted to continue that thought. And we are probably best to move on to our third and final speaker, Dr. Ronald Kohansky. And thank you very much, Michelle, for your presentation. Please stick around because we will have time to maybe get to the one or two more questions that were addressed to you after Dr. Kohansky's presentation. Without further ado, we will hear from Dr. Kohansky, the Deputy Director of the Division of Aging Biology at the National Institute on Aging at NIH. Dr. Kohansky joined the Division of Aging Biology at NIA in 2005 as a program officer and became the Division Deputy Director in 2007. He has promoted aging research in the specific areas of stem cell biology and cardiovascular biology. More broadly, he promotes research efforts to expand studies beyond laboratory animals to address the basic biology of aging explicitly in human populations and non-laboratory animals. Dr. Kohansky is also a co-founder and co-leader of the Trans-NIH Geroscience Interest Group. This group spans the entire NIH and is built on the fact that aging is a major risk factor for most chronic age-related diseases. A full bio is available on the webinar homepage. Dr. Kohansky, I will now turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, Heather. First of all, thank you, Heather and Sarah, for organizing this symposium, making it possible. I'd also like to thank two colleagues at NIEHS for bringing me into the fold on questions of environment as they intersect with aging, and those are Michelle Heacock and Seema Finn. We were engaged in writing from my side on behalf of the Geroscience Interest Group and NIA a couple of programming announcements related to aging and the environment. Also, I can say that I have no conflicts of interest. So what I'll attempt to do in the course of this talk is build a conceptual framework for understanding aging and how it's a risk for chronic diseases and how that may intersect with interests in how the environment influences our health. And as Martin Smith pointed out earlier, hallmarks are what the biology is. And the biology in what are, the, are considered the hallmarks of aging have to do with circumstances where the biology that is supporting the body during development and in the a reproductively successful period of life and shortly thereafter, that biology begins to not function that well. So our stress response abilities decline with age. We find that there's increased senescence in the body. Now, cellular senescence occurs during development and throughout the lifespan, but and it has important features, partly as a break on replication in cells and perhaps a defense against tumorigenesis. But senescent cells that are lingering can affect other cells in the neighborhood and overall can have an impact on health. So there's a move afoot these days to find ways of diminishing the number of senescent cells in an organism with the hopes of improving health, and may even be relevant in the current COVID-19 pandemic. Proteostasis is a part of the what happens in intracellularly, covering everything from protein, from the translation of proteins off of the messenger RNA, to their processing, post-translational modifications, folding, movement to their locations of function in the cell, or as secreted proteins or the cell surface, and also how they are degraded. So it's a complex pathway involving 10%, roughly speaking, of the genome. So you could actually say that the 600 processes that go on in the cell, each one uses 10% of the genome. So there's some overlap at the molecular level in terms of how these different functions are supported. Inflammation is well known to increase with age, chronic inflammation. That's inflammation that doesn't have an acute provocation. It's not a response to an infection. This inflammatory milieu simply increases with age. Immune responses are known to go down. So in children, the risk of immune responsiveness is that the system has yet to develop. And in older people, the immune system has become occupied, so to speak, with cells that are there reflecting the history of infections and immune responses to pathogens. You could say that the space has somewhat diminished in older age for mounting new and effective responses to challenges. Metabolism is something that certainly goes is not as efficient as it was earlier in life in older people. It's fundamentally the same metabolism. It's not as if new things have come in or things have dropped out entirely. Metabolism is a paradigm of what goes on in biology, which is, relatively speaking, not so much all or none, but more or less. And that's one of the problems in metabolism. And Michelle Amaro referred to changes in metabolism in response to some environmental factors, and I hope to touch on that again later in the talk and relate back to her comments. And then there's damage of all kinds of things, damage of every type of macromolecule and metabolite in the cell. A lot of the reactions that take place during metabolism are inefficient. They have side products, and those side products can be damaging. That damage can accumulate most prominently in DNA. So it's not just that there would be mutations arising that are not repaired or other alterations in the genome. But there are failures to methylate in specific sites because of the way the genome or the chromatin refolds, and other forms of damage in the DNA in particular that's of interest. And so that also includes damage of the telomeres. The telomere erosion is a particular problem. So with all this aging biology that takes place, what's underneath it? It's fairly complex. So you have these hallmarks of aging. This is a slightly different list than the one that was in the previous figure. But fundamentally, you can populate this with any of two dozen characteristics of biology. So inside of any hallmark, here's an example from proteostasis. In the cell, there is a whole series of mechanisms, as mentioned, for protein synthesis, processing, and degradation. And a lot of degradation takes place in the lysosomes in addition to the ATP-dependent ubiquitin pathway. On inside of one of these components, as an example, are the regulatory gene networks for lysosomal formation, for the formation of the components of the lysosome, and also the regulatory networks for autophagy, which is one of the processes that the lysosome engages in, cell basically eating itself. So you go from very complicated molecular networks to less occupied but equally complicated cellular networks up to the level of measurables and proteostasis. You can make measurements all along the way, but these are the hallmarks of aging that are concerning to us as they affect multiple tissues. So changes in the efficiency of the hallmarks of aging will result in changes in various tissues. Very well known issues with loss of cognitive function and dementias, which are of specific interest to my institute, National Institute on Aging, as well as neurological diseases, NINDS. Things go bad in the intestines, not just the cells of the intestines themselves, but also in the metabolome, in the microbiome that's there, liver, kidney. You can go around here and find almost anything will go wrong, and everything does with age to varying degrees. Aging is highly idiotypic. But one of the things that the geroscience field considers is that these various changes in the hallmarks of aging result in or are risk factors for chronic diseases. Heart disease, cancer are major killers. Diabetes, which used to be really type 2 diabetes, was considered an adult onset, but with the advent of greater obesity and other issues, it's moved leftward in the age spectrum. And so many children suffer from type 2 diabetes as well, the chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and so on. Some diseases which are prevalent in children will be less prevalent in adults, of course. So the view of geroscience is that these hallmarks of aging, which are aging in general, are risk factors for a range of diseases. In fact, if you look at the multiple risk factors uncovered in the Framingham study, the single most significant conveyance of risk is age, or the processes that are underlying age. So what you end up with aging is an increased burden of chronic diseases, often referred to as comorbidities. People will have multiple prevalence of multiple chronic conditions are greater in older people than in younger people. Although, of course, that is influenced dramatically by the environment. If you look at the burden of chronic disease in New York boroughs, for example, it's shockingly high starting at an early age. The number of people who have six or more chronic conditions is astonishing. But what one finds in looking at multiple chronic conditions is the age distribution basically breaks down this way. People under the age of 44, early midlife, may have one or two of these chronic conditions. Again, kind of a national average, and varies with locale. And in the age group of 45 to 64, these are 2010 data, I believe, you'll see an increase in the number of people with two or more chronic conditions. And for three or greater than four chronic conditions, the dominant group would be those over 65. So it's not as if all of the people in that age group are going to have four conditions, but those who have four or more chronic conditions, more of them are in the older age group than in the younger age groups. And these chronic conditions as analyzed in that study included hypertension, some of which appear to be interrelated diseases, of course. But hypertension, heart disease, hyperlipidemia, diabetes, and so on. So you get to the question of how do you approach these problems? Because if you're looking to study these conditions for their genetic components, or if you're looking to take apart the organism to find out what's happened in different tissues or different cell types, you're unlikely to do that in people. It would be unethical. And you can, within certain clear restrictions, do these in lab animals as well, with greater facility and with greater tractability. You can manipulate the genotypes of lab animals fairly easily now with the technologies of CRISPR and so on. But and also many of the laboratory animals that are used have their genomes sequenced. So when we speak of lab animals, we might talk about mice, but what is really meant is C57 Black 6 mice that are either the NIH strain or the Jackson Laboratory strain, two strains which differ significantly in their genotypes, actually. But there are other highly inbred mice, and people are using F1 and F2 generation mice to get some greater genetic heterogeneity in the experiments. There are highly isogenic animals that are being used, such as the Caenorhabditis elegans, which is the M2 strain that Sydney Brenner brought to the fore some years ago. And there are other species and strains of Caenorhabditis distributed around the world. And those Caenorhabditis, three species and nine strains alone have more genetic diversity than the entire human population. So they make an interesting basis for studying the genotypes related to disease, although they are invertebrates. And similarly, Drosophila melanogaster are used quite extensively, one of the paradigm organisms for the study of genetics along with yeast, which came out of Columbia University and Johns Hopkins more than a century ago. And those animals have proven very useful in the study of aging. They're probably less used in the study of environmental factors than mammals because of their evolutionary distance. Nevertheless, they can be quite informative, either because they do suffer some of these chronic conditions or they don't suffer such chronic conditions. So there are animals of interest that have high regenerative capacity, such as planaria, which we lack. Zebrafish, which is a vertebrate but not a mammal, they have high regenerative capacity as well, again, which after birth anyway, we certainly lack. Some animals out there simply do not appear to get much in the way of cancer, such as the naked mole rat, occupying a specific ecological niche. So you take your lab animal according to what you wish to study and for its characteristics. But in lab animals, there's an approach called geropathology, which means the a pathological analysis of diseases and functional loss in older animals. So you can do these kinds of analyses in an animal at any age. In the lab, you sacrifice the animal, and you turn it over to a pathologist who then gives you an analysis. Some years ago, Stuart Kim, who was at Stanford University at the time, looked at kidney aging and related kidney aging to function and to gene expression profiles in the kidney, both in humans and in laboratory mice, had that perfected to the point where from the gene expression profile you could accurately identify the age of the donor and the presence of various diseases. But you can look down the list here. In humans, you can measure lung function, which you can also measure in lab animals. They do get pneumonia, and you can give it to them as well. Although in some cases, such as, for example, COVID-19 infection, the coronavirus that infects humans affects the nasal cavity and the lungs quite dramatically, whereas in mice, generally speaking, the coronavirus affects the liver, although in rats, it also affects the lungs. A great deal has been done in terms of bones, joints, and muscles, and skin in lab animals compared to humans, although a lot of the molecular details, for example, in skin, wound healing in skin differ in mice compared to humans. You can always attempt to humanize the mouse model or the rodent model. So the question becomes, if you have all of this available and you're going to look at changes in condition with age, whatever the influence is, just age without other disruptions, you can take an example from the way a newborn child is evaluated using the Apgar score, which is actually named for Virginia Apgar, who was a physician, a pediatrician at, OBGYN, first female professor at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. And so she evaluated children at birth based on these five criteria, and the child would get a score. And then based on what the specific issue was, you would then know where to look to provide remediation if necessary. So in a newborn, you have, again, this is for newborn Caucasian children. You would look for various features and appearance. It's different for other ethnic groups. But these are otherwise the same. And you can ask if you have a similar kind of functional evaluation in adults, where if you're going to look at aging, you would want to have the same tests in late-life adults as you would have in midlife adults. So you could look for response time and memory in terms of cognition, which is something you don't evaluate in a newborn. You could look at skin tone, body mass index, hair, all of these things. At birth, of course, these are dramatically influenced by conditions of the mother and genotype. But in midlife adults, you also have the entire history of the person as they've lived, and then how that appears in late life adults. So one of the problems in older adults, of course, is, can be cachexia or unintended weight loss, skin wrinkling, hair graying, which are indicative of changes below the surface. Hair graying certainly doesn't represent a particular risk of anything that we know about. You can look at pulse plus or minus exertion so that you can get some indication of resilience, the ability to return to baseline after some perturbation. And the same for what was grimace in a child or newborn. It could be response to various stimuli in the periphery or centrally, and it would be the same tests. Neurologists use various nerve function tests to look for nerve conduction, which often is lower in adults, but is also influenced by behaviors such as excessive consumption of alcohol, for example. And of course, there's motion and resistance to motion, which midlife adults are going to have greater facility than old life adults. And no matter how hard you try, it will decline. The more you take care of yourself, the less the decline, but nevertheless, with aging, you lose some of it. And respiration, of course, is also measurable. There are multiple parameters for these various things: heart rate returning to baseline too quickly, too slowly, irregularities. These are lung breathing and heart rate, of course, are very complex patterns of function and can be deconvoluted to tell you where there are specific issues, but generally speaking, they can give you relative fitness. These, of course, are not that easy to do on a longitudinal basis because there's a 20 to 30 year gap between midlife to late life adults, but there are such longitudinal studies going on. So if you ask them about geroscience for aging in a challenging environment, and our environments are quite challenging, you can say that these various inputs are from medications, taken under prescription or otherwise, behaviors such as sedentary versus mobile activities, including sleep and sleep patterns, and of course the environment in various forms. All of these impact the hallmarks, the biology that's ongoing. And these come out in ways that are clinically important in terms of the various diseases, the chronic diseases that people suffer, but also in the activities of daily living. Can you engage in commerce, take care of your nutrition, have an interaction with your environment, which, let's say, this is meant differently from here. This is your computer, people around you, et cetera, which would include communication. Are you able to get in and out of a chair? Can you take care of your hygiene? These are basics that when you have people in nursing home environments, each one of these is a critical issue. But before then, there are interventions that are envisioned that might ease the loss of function in these various areas. But all of these come out through two aspects of the same prism, which would be resilience, that is the ability to respond to a perturbation, and frailty, which would be increased risk of death under stress, pretty much. So let's take one example. Oh, sorry. So there are extreme changes in the environment, of course. We know about these oil tanker fires and train wrecks, tornadoes, floods, which have their impact short-term and long-term, because certainly escaping any of these and getting housed in away from your normal environment into the stress of communal living, which is just hard to envision, but obviously happens to large numbers of people, and also impacts the minority populations to a greater extent, and also to people living in poverty to a greater extent than others. But then there are also the toxic waste sites and the garbage dumps, where the exposure to these, again, may vary with your social and economic status. But it's not all about the horrible things. Sometimes there are seemingly benign changes in the environment. So this is an example about breast cancer. And more than half of breast cancer in women have no identified risk factor at this point, or as of 2014 anyway. But there are known movements of people from one location, Japan, to another location, Hawaii. And in Japan, the incidence of breast cancer tends to be in the younger population. So this is per 100,000 people. It's a density. It's not number of cases. It's the relative proportion. So if you look at the distribution of breast cancers in women in Hawaii, there's a bimodal distribution. There is a greater incidence of older age women with cancer. So if you then have people moving from Japan, or who were Japanese, but are now living in Hawaii, or their descendants, you find that there's an increase in, there's a shift in the distribution. So that would suggest that there's definitely a difference between the two environments for what is essentially the same genotype. And that's not necessarily, it's not obviously a harsh change in environment. It's not like moving next to a toxic waste dump, although I can't say that for sure. But if you ask what it is that's involved in this age onset risk for cancer or incidence of cancer, that has been investigated by many people. The work that I'm going to cite next is from Mark LaBarge, who's a grantee of the National Institute on Aging, also the National Cancer Institute. It basically comes down to the epigenome and to some stem cells. Of among all the hallmarks of aging, these seem to dominate. So the way the experiments are done is there's a tissue bank of normal human mammary tissue from different age groups. So it covers the range from 17 to 91, I believe it is. And there are hundreds of samples now, but the work originally was done with a pool of 57 samples. The way this is done is to take this material and to make organoids in culture. And this is done under conditions where if you look at the signatures, whether they are gene expression profiles, RNA sequencing, protein expression, et cetera, or cell morphologies, what has been accomplished in these experiments is that the phenotype of these breast tissue organoids recapitulates the age of the donor. So the old-aged organoids do not revert to a younger age phenotype, and the younger do not revert to an old or take on an older-aged phenotype. So this allows a lot of experiments to be done with human material in situations where you can track what's going on with antibodies, and you can also do gene expression. So you have taken samples from operations, whether they are for breast cancer surgeries or for cosmetic reasons, these tissues are available. And you can interrogate this human tissue for a range of features, including cell lineages. So here's an analysis of cell lineages in these tissues, which compares fundamentally the cell lineages that occur in younger versus middle-aged versus older people, all in the absence of disease. So none of the disease alleles are present, none of the gene expression profiles are present that identify these as cancer cells. So these are not cancerous. And one can do a lineage tracing. Actually, you do this with metal-labeled antibodies and mass spectrometry, and you can look at 49 different markers at the same time and create what's called a pseudo-time series, which is a way of generating a lineage by successively overlapping antigens that are expressed on cells. And so you can map out cell lineages that take place. And in these cells, there's basically two concerns. One is the luminal epithelial cells, and the other is the myoepithelial cells. And it turns out that the luminal epithelial cells, which are involved in these cancer risks, these cells change with age. And they change in such a way that these altered cells, these aged cells, have characteristics that are precursors of tumorigenesis. And these are affected, actually, by their microenvironments. So with age in the mammary tissue, there's an increase in fat cells. And these fat cells increase not only the expression of specific growth factor, but the changes in the luminal epithelial cells themselves have differences in the receptor for that growth factor. So you have two biological events converging. One is the stochastic rise, if you will, in the receptor, as well as the rise in the source of the ligand for the receptor, which affects the cell growth characteristics and apparently the susceptibility for cancer. In addition to which, there are changes in the epigenetic marks, the DNA methylation, that identify these cells as being at risk for cancer. So those are the two aspects. So Michelle Amaral had mentioned some studies on DTT and its metabolite DTE in early life, in gestation and childhood, how these carry forward into increased levels of obesity later in life. This is one of the things that's of great interest also in the biology of aging, how things that occur very early will affect later life features, but also changes anywhere along the life course will impact what is going on later in life, as well as impacts that occur on older people directly. So things can be fine all along here, but your ability to respond to changes in the environment, et cetera, are difficult. So how do you do this in people? So here you have all of these hallmarks of aging, each of which contributes in some respect to risk for disease, as well as being interconnected to each other. And these are the kinds of things that you might get measured in a doctor's visit. Fecal samples, nasal samples, their fat biopsies are possible. Stem cells can be applied from blood lineages. You can look at fibrosis from ultrasound, et cetera. Blood is a favorite source of information. So you go to the doctor, here's what it's going to look like. All of the different things that you're going to sample from breath, urine, and plasma can give you information on not only the metabolome, but the metabolism of the organism, as well as blood producing a range of information. And they will all map to the hallmarks of aging. So what you'd like to be able to do, at least in terms of people, is these are accessible. Keep moving. Forget to move the marker. These are accessible clinically in a doctor's visit, and these are also accessible clinically in a doctor's exam. So you can combine these. And this was done very recently by the Brunet and Snyder labs at Stanford University, mostly the work of Michael Snyder. And this is rate of aging in humans. And the encouraging thing about this is that you can find out a person's aging trajectory and health trajectory in a period of 2 to 3 years. Whereas things that affect someone from midlife to late adult life are interesting. That's a 20 to 30 year period. Here you can find out what's going on. These are individual health trajectories, if you will, for different people. And so you have the laboratory samples and the doctor's visit where personal information is collected. That's both functional and molecular. And these are combined through some nice equations to give you an ageotype, as it were. And some people are aging at greater than the average rate, and some people's health appears to increase with age as opposed to declining with age. So it's possible to work with humans to address some critical issues. But basically, vis-a-vis aging, the molecular hallmarks will allow us to understand the interactions between the environment and aging. One example having been breast cancer, although we don't yet know what the environmental influences are specifically in that case. We do know what many of the risk factors are from the environmental exposures. But again, a lot remains to be done on that and other diseases. There's clinically useful information that can be obtained in a short period of time, and you can get individual information on it. It's not just the average, but you get information individually. And the biology of aging, established in laboratory animals of all sorts, and fungi, I have to say yeast or fungi, you can get information that is biologically useful and relevant in humans. And as far as aging in a challenging environment, this gives you a background against which to explore a variety of environmental factors that influence aging and the things that come along with age, which are increased burden of chronic disease and decreased resilience and increased frailty. And these are in the two PAR that NIA joined with NIEHS and other institutes. You can look at effects of the environment that are chronic, acute, and combined. And with that, I will conclude. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Gohansky. This was a very fascinating overview of the hallmarks of aging. At this time, we have, I'd like to allow folks to submit their questions. We are running up close to the end, but we might have time for one or two questions. No, that's fine. This was a really nice overview and fit very well with the presentations of Dr. Martin, Dr. LaMerrill, so we definitely appreciate this. So one question we have on everybody's mind, how can you use the hallmarks of aging to understand the increased risks from COVID-19 infection?
That's a very good question. and there are some potential answers to that. So explications just recently came out on a genotype that's an increased risk for dementia, which is one of the APOE alleles. And the publication demonstrates pretty well from existing data in the UK Biobank that there's an increased risk of a patient experiencing delirium or dementia, delirium in the hospital and dementia outside of the hospital. So in a clinically useful setting, or potentially useful setting is if you had that genotypic information for the patient coming in, you could be prepared in advance to deal with the delirium. In a broader sense, there are many ways that in which the immune system declines, and immune responsiveness is critical to of dealing with a viral infection from the point of view of the infected body. There are possible avenues to boost immune response, which one of which would be to attempt to reduce the number of senescent cells that are present in the respiratory tract. And also in other parts of the body, because once the respiratory tract gets the response to the infection, other parts of the body suffer tremendously as well. Another thing is that there seems to be some link between responsiveness to viruses and telomere length. And telomere attrition is something that happens with age. So there may be risks, greater risks for people who have either hereditarily shortened telomeres, which may or may not be an issue in some of the young children who are suffering unusual symptoms not anticipated in COVID-19 infections, but also in older people where telomere attrition has taken place. So it's not just the cell replication type of crisis that would occur with short telomeres, but there are other things that happen when telomeres are shortened, such as unmasking of otherwise cryptic genes, which then get expressed aberrantly, and they can affect how cells respond as well. So there are a lot of factors. There's also metabolism, which would be critical in all likelihood, because a lot of the immune responsiveness requires efficient metabolism. So that could be perhaps something oddly simple like adding NAD to a person's, I'm not suggesting anybody try this. But we know that NAD can boost immune responsiveness. So you know there's lots of options out there.
Okay.
I'm never suggesting that anybody try anything.
Sure. I think that's a really nice way to wrap up a really wonderful webinar here. We are still getting a couple more questions. Some of them are very specific, and we promise that we will have our speakers address the questions offline.
Yes.
So, but at this time, we would like to let you know about a few resources, and so I wanted to make sure everyone knows about the related URLs pod. This includes the seminar resources and the seminar feedback form. Resources are assembled from directly applicable to today's topic, so please have a look at that. It will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. Also, the slides are there. In addition, we'll also have a soundtrack, so in the future you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today and forward it to all your friends who you wish could have been able to listen as well. We also have that seminar feedback form, and we would like to ask you to please fill that out, because we look at your comments and helps us improve the content and delivery mechanism of our webinars. If you need confirmation that you attended this webinar, you can also request that in the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. And I would like to remind participants of the variety of ways to stay connected. For more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the cluin.org website. You can also subscribe to the monthly e-newsletter, TechDirect, and follow CLUIN on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. We encourage you to visit the SRP Risk E-Learning webpage for more information about upcoming sessions. And you can also follow SRP on Twitter. And speaking of upcoming sessions, we do have two more sessions in the disease latency series, June 8th and June 16th. The third session will be looking at arsenic as a case study, and the fourth session will be talking about a new emerging toxicology and modeling methods, as well